to you," William said. "I suppose you're going to say that the income from the shiring market and the fleece fair is down, too."
"Yes.
Then why don't you increase the rents and taxes?"
"We have, Lord, on the orders of your late father, but the income has gone down nonetheless."
With such an unproductive estate, how did Bartholomew keep body and soul together? William said in exasperation. Arthur even had an answer for that.
He had the quarry, also. That brought in a great deal of money, in the old days.
And now it's in the hands of that damned monk. William was shaken. Just when he needed to make an ostentatious display, he was being told that he was penniless. The situation was very dangerous for him. The king had just granted him custody of an earldom. It was a kind of probation. If he returned to court with a diminutive army, it would seem ungrateful, even disloyal. Besides, the picture Arthur had painted could not be entirely true. William felt sure people were cheating him, and they were probably laughing about it behind his back, too. The thought made him angry. He was not going to tolerate it. He would show them. There would be bloodshed before he accepted defeat.
"You've got an excuse for everything," he said to Arthur.
"The fact is, you've let this estate run to seed during my father's illness, which is when you ought to have been most vigilant."
"But, Lord,"
William raised his voice, "shut your mouth or I'll have you flogged." Arthur paled and went silent. William said, "Starting tomorrow, we're going on a tour of the earldom. We're going to visit every village I own and shake them all up. You may not know how to deal with whining, lying peasants, but I do. We'll soon find out how impoverished my earldom is. And if you've lied to me, I swear to God you'll be the first of many hangings." As well as Arthur, he took his groom, Walter, and the other four knights who had fought beside him for the past year, Ugly Gervaise, Hugh Axe, Gilbert Durance, and Miles Dice. They were all big, violent men, quick to anger and always ready to fight. They rode their best horses and went armed to the teeth to scare the peasantry. William believed that a man was helpless unless people were afraid of him. It was a hot day in late summer, and the wheat stood in fat sheaves in the fields. The abundance of visible wealth made William all the more angry that he had no money. Someone must be robbing him. They ought to be too frightened to dare. His family had won the earldom when Bartholomew was disgraced, and yet he was penniless, while Bartholomew's son had plenty. The idea that people were stealing from him and laughing at his unsuspecting ignorance gnawed at him like a stomachache, and he got angrier as he rode along. He had decided to begin at Northbrook, a small village somewhat remote from the castle. The villagers were a mixture of serfs and freemen. The serfs were William's property and could not do anything without his permission. They owed him so many days' work at certain times of year, plus a share of their own crops. The freemen just paid him rent in cash or in kind. Five of them were in arrears. William had a notion that they thought they could get away with it because they were far from the castle. It might be a good place to begin the shake-up. It was a long ride, and the sun was high when they approached the village. There were 20 or 30 houses surrounded by 3 big fields, all of them now stubble. Near the houses, at the edge of one of the fields, were 3 large oak trees in a group. As William and his men drew near, he saw that most of the villagers appeared to be sitting in the shade of the oaks, eating their dinner. He spurred his horse into a canter for the last few hundred yards, and the others followed suit. They halted in front of the villagers in a cloud of dust. As the villagers were scrambling to their feet, swallowing their horse bread and trying to keep the dust out of their eyes, William's mistrustful gaze observed a curious little drama. A middle-aged man with a black beard spoke quietly but urgently to a plump, red-cheeked girl with a plump, red-cheeked baby. A young man joined them and was hastily shooed away by the older man. Then the girl walked off toward the houses, apparently under protest, and disappeared in the dust. William was intrigued. There was something furtive about the whole scene, and he wished Mother were here to interpret it. He decided to do nothing about it for the moment. He addressed Arthur in a voice loud enough for them all to hear. 5 of my free tenants here are in arrears. Is that right?
Yes, Lord.
Who is the worst? Athelstan hasn't paid for 2 years, but he was very unlucky with his pigs. William spoke over Arthur, cutting him off. Which one of you is Athelstan? A tall, stoop-shouldered man of about 45 years stepped forward. He had thinning hair and watery eyes. William said, Why don't you pay me rent? Lord, it's a small holding, and I've no one to help me now that my boys have gone to work in the town, and then there was the swine fever. Just a moment, William said. Where did your sons go?
To Kingsbridge, Lord, to work on the new cathedral there, for they want to marry, as young men must, and my land won't support 3 families.
William tucked away in his memory for future reflection the information that the young men had gone to work on Kingsbridge Cathedral.
Your holding is big enough to support 1 family at any rate, but still you don't pay your rent.
Athelstan began to talk about his pigs again. William stared malevolently at him without listening.
I know why you haven't paid, he thought.
You knew your lord was ill, and you decided to cheat him while he was incapable of enforcing his rights. The other 4 delinquents thought the same. You rob us when we're weak. For a moment he was full of self-pity. The 5 of them had been chuckling over their cleverness, he felt sure. Well, now they would learn their lesson.
Gilbert and Hugh, take this peasant and hold him still, he said quietly.
Athelstan was still talking. The 2 knights dismounted and approached him. His tale of swine fever tailed off into nothing. The knights took him by the arms. He turned pale with fear. William spoke to Walter in the same quiet voice. Have you got your chainmail gloves?
Yes, Lord.
Put them on. Teach Athelstan a lesson, but make sure he lives to spread the word.
Yes, Lord.
Walter took from his saddlebag a pair of leather gauntlets with fine chainmail sewn to the knuckles and the backs of the fingers. He pulled them on slowly. All the villagers watched in dread, and Athelstan began to moan with terror. Walter got off his horse, walked over to Athelstan, and punched him in the stomach with 1 mailed fist. The thud as the blow landed was sickeningly loud. Athelstan doubled over, too winded to cry out. Gilbert and Hugh pulled him upright, and Walter punched his face. Blood spurted from his mouth and nose. One of the onlookers, a woman who was presumably his wife, screamed out and jumped on Walter, yelling, Stop! Leave him! Don't kill him! Walter brushed her off, and 2 other women grabbed her and pulled her back. She continued to scream and struggle. The other peasants watched in mutinous silence as Walter beat Athelstan systematically until his body was limp, his face covered with blood, and his eyes closed in unconsciousness.
Let him go, William said at last.
Gilbert and Hugh released Athelstan. He slumped to the ground and lay still. The women released the wife, and she ran to him, sobbing, and knelt beside him. Walter took off the gauntlets and wiped the blood and pieces of flesh off the chainmail. William had already lost interest in Athelstan. Looking around the village, he saw a new-looking 2-story wooden structure built on the edge of the brook. He pointed to it and said to Arthur,
What's that?
I haven't seen it before, Lord, Arthur said nervously.
William thought he was lying.
It's a watermill, isn't it?
Arthur shrugged, but his indifference was unconvincing.
I can't imagine what else it would be right there by the stream.
How could he be so insolent when he had just seen a peasant beaten half to death on William's orders? Almost desperately, William said, Are my serfs allowed to build mills without my permission?
No, Lord.
Do you know why this is prohibited?
So that they will bring their grain to the Lord's mills and pay him to grind it for them, and the Lord will profit.
Yes, Lord.
Arthur spoke in the condescending tone of one who explains something elementary to a child. But if they pay a fine for building a mill, the Lord will profit just the same. William found his tone maddening.
No, he won't profit just the same. The fine is never as much as the peasants would otherwise have to pay. That's why they love to build mills, and that's why my father would never let them.
Without giving Arthur the chance to reply, he kicked his horse and rode over to the mill. His knights followed, and the villagers tailed along behind them in a ragged crowd. William dismounted. There was no doubt about what the building was. A large water wheel was turning under the pressure of the fast-flowing stream. The wheel turned a shaft which went through the side wall of the mill. It was a solid wooden construction, made to last. Whoever built it had clearly expected to be free to use it for years. The miller stood outside the open door, wearing a prepared expression of injured innocence. In the room behind him were sacks of grain in neat stacks. William dismounted. The miller bowed to him politely, but was there not a hint of scorn in his look? Once again William had the painful sense that these people thought he was a nobody, and his inability to impose his will on them made him feel impotent. Indignation and frustration welled up in him, and he yelled at the miller furiously, "Whatever made you think you could get away with this? Do you imagine that I'm stupid? Is that it? Is that what you think?" Then he punched the man in the face. The miller gave an exaggerated cry of pain and fell to the ground, quite unnecessarily. William stepped over him and went inside. The shaft of the water wheel was connected, by a set of wooden gears, to the shaft of the grindstone on the upper floor. The milled grain fell through a chute to the threshing floor at ground level. The second floor, which had to bear the weight of the grindstone, was supported by four stout timbers, taken from William's forest without permission, undoubtedly. If the timbers were cut, the whole building would fall. William went outside. Hugh Axe carried the weapon from which he got his name, strapped to his saddle. William said, "Give me a battle axe." Hugh obliged. William went back inside and began to attack the timber supports of the upper floor. It gave him great satisfaction to feel the blade of the axe thud into the building that the peasants had so carefully constructed in their attempt to cheat him of his milling fees. "They aren't laughing at me now," he thought savagely. Walter came in and stood watching. William hacked a deep notch in one of the supports, and then cut halfway through a second. The platform above, which carried the enormous weight of the millstone, began to tremble. William said, "Get a rope." Walter went out. William cut into the other two timbers as deeply as he dared. The building was ready to collapse. Walter came back with some rope. William tied the rope to one of the timbers, then carried the other end outside and tied it around the neck of his warhorse. The peasants watched in sullen silence. When the rope was fixed, William said, "Where's the miller?" The miller approached, still trying to look like one who is being unjustly dealt with. William said, "Gervaise, tie him up and put him inside." The miller made a break for it, but Gilbert tripped him and sat on him, and Gervaise tied his hands and feet with leather thongs. The two knights picked him up. He began to struggle and plead for mercy. One of the villagers stepped out of the crowd and said, "You can't do this! It's murder! Even a lord can't murder people!" William pointed a trembling finger at him. "If you open your mouth again, I'll put you inside with him." For a moment the man looked defiant. Then he thought better of it and turned away. The knights came out of the mill. William walked his horse forward until it had taken up the slack in the rope. He slapped its rump, and it took the strain. Inside the building the miller began to scream. The noise was blood-curdling. It was the sound of a man in mortal terror, a man who knew that within the next few moments he was going to be crushed to death. The horse tossed its head, trying to slacken the rope around its neck. William yelled at it and kicked its rump to make it pull, then shouted at his knights, "Heave on the rope, you men!" The four knights grabbed the taut rope and pulled with the horse. The villagers' voices were raised in protest, but they were all too frightened to interfere. Arthur was standing to one side, looking sick. The miller's screams became more shrill. William imagined the blind terror that must be possessing the man as he waited for his dreadful death. "None of these peasants will ever forget the revenge of the Hamleys," he thought. The timber creaked loudly. Then there was a loud crack as it broke. The horse bounded forward and the knights let go of the rope. A corner of the roof sagged. The women began to wail. The wooden walls of the mill seemed to shudder. The miller's screams rose higher. There was a mighty crash as the upper floor gave way. The screaming was cut off abruptly, and the ground shook as the grindstone landed on the threshing floor. The walls splintered, the roof caved in, and in a moment the mill was nothing but a pile of firewood with a dead man inside it. William began to feel better. Some of the villagers ran forward and began to dig into the debris frantically. If they were hoping to find the miller alive, they would be disappointed. His body would be a grisly sight. That was all to the good. Looking around, William spotted the red-cheeked girl with the red-cheeked baby, standing at the back of the crowd as if she were trying to be inconspicuous. He remembered how the man with the black beard, presumably her father, had been keen to keep her out of sight. He decided to solve that mystery before leaving the village. He caught her eye and beckoned her. She looked behind her, hoping he was pointing at someone else. "You," William said. "Come here." The man with the black beard saw her and gave a grunt of exasperation. William said, "Who's your husband, wench?" The father said, "She has no—" He was too late, however, for the girl said, "Edmund, so you are married. But who's your father?" "I am," said the man with the black beard, "Tybalt." William turned to Arthur. "Is Tybalt a free man?"
"He's a serf, lord.
And when a serf's daughter marries, is it not the lord's right, as her owner, to enjoy her on the wedding night?" Arthur was shocked. "Lord, that primitive custom has not been enforced in this part of the world in living memory." "True," said William. "The father pays a fine instead. How much did Tybalt pay?"
"He hasn't paid yet, lord, but—"
"Not paid? And she with a fat, red-cheeked child?" Tybalt said, "We never had the money, lord, and she was with child by Edmund and wanted to be wed, but we can pay now, for we've got the crop in." William smiled at the girl.
"Let me see the baby."
She stared at him fearfully.
"Come, give it to me."
She was afraid, but she could not bring herself to hand over her baby. William stepped closer and gently took the child from her. Her eyes filled with terror, but she did not resist him. The baby began to squall. William held it for a moment, then grasped both its ankles in one hand, and with a swift motion threw it into the air as high as he could. The girl screamed like a banshee and gazed into the air as the baby flew upward. The father ran forward with his arms outstretched to catch it as it fell. While the girl was looking up and screaming, William took a handful of her dress and ripped it. She had a pink, rounded young body. The father caught the baby safely. The girl turned to run, but William caught her and threw her to the ground. The father handed the baby to a woman and turned to look at William. William said, "As I wasn't given my due on the wedding night, and the fine hasn't been paid, I'll take what's owed me now." The father rushed at him. William drew his sword. The father stopped. William looked at the girl lying on the ground, trying to cover her nakedness with her hands. Her fear aroused him. "And when I've done, my knights will have her too," he said with a contented smile. 2. In 3 years, Kingsbridge had changed beyond recognition. William had not been here since the Whitsun day when Philip and his army of volunteers had frustrated Walleran by God's scheme. Then it had been 40 or 50 wooden houses clustered around the priory gate and scattered along the muddy footpath that led to the bridge. Now, he saw, as he approached the village across the undulating fields, there were 3 times as many houses at least. They formed a brown fringe all around the grey stone wall of the priory, and completely filled the space between the priory and the river. Several of the houses looked large. Within the priory close, there were new stone buildings, and the walls of the church seemed to be going up fast. There were 2 new quays beside the river. Kingsbridge had become a town. The appearance of the place confirmed a suspicion that had been growing in his mind since he had come home from the war. As he had toured around, collecting arrears of rent and terrorizing disobedient serfs, he had continually heard talk of Kingsbridge. Landless young men were going there to work. Prosperous families were sending their sons to school at the priory. Smallholders would sell their eggs and cheese to the men working on the building site, and everyone who could went there on holy days, even though there was no cathedral. Today was a holy day, Michaelmas Day, which fell on a Sunday this year. It was a mild early autumn morning, nice weather for travelling, so there should be a good crowd. William expected to find out what drew them to Kingsbridge. His five henchmen rode with him. They had done sterling work in the villages. The news of William's tour had spread with uncanny speed, and after the first few days people knew what to expect. At William's approach they would send the children and young women to hide in the woods. It pleased William to strike fear into people's hearts. It kept them in their place. They certainly knew he was in command now. As his group came closer to Kingsbridge, he kicked his horse into a trot and the others followed suit. Arriving at speed was always more impressive. Other people shrank back to the sides of the road or jumped into the fields to get out of the way of the big horses. They clattered over the wooden bridge, making a loud noise and ignoring the toll housekeeper, but the narrow street ahead of them was blocked by a cart loaded with barrels of lime and pulled by two huge, slow-moving oxen, and the knight's horses were forced to slow abruptly. William looked around as they followed the cart up the hill. New houses, hastily built, filled the spaces between the old ones. He noticed a cookshop, an alehouse, a smithy, and a shoemaker's. The air of prosperity was unmistakable. William was envious. There were not many people in the streets, however. Perhaps they were all up at the priory. With his knights behind him, he followed the ox cart through the priory gates. It was not the kind of entrance he liked to make, and he had a pang of anxiety that people would notice and laugh at him, but happily nobody even looked. By contrast with the deserted town outside the walls, the priory close was humming with activity. William reined in and looked around, trying to take it all in. There were so many people, and there was so much going on, that at first he found it somewhat bewildering. Then the scene resolved into three sections. Nearest him, at the western end of the priory close, there was a market. The stalls were set up in neat north-south rows, and several hundred people were milling about in the aisles, buying food and drink, hats and shoes, knives, belts, ducklings, puppies, pots, earrings, wool, thread, rope, and dozens of other necessities and luxuries. The market was clearly thriving, and all the pennies, halfpennies, and farthings that were changing hands must add up to a great deal of money. It was no wonder, William thought bitterly, that the market at Shiring was in decline, when there was a flourishing alternative here at Kingsbridge. The rents from stallholders, tolls on suppliers, and taxes on sales that should have been going into the Earl of Shiring's treasury were instead filling the coffers of Kingsbridge Priory. But a market needed a license from the king, and William was sure Prior Philip did not have one. He was probably planning to apply as soon as he was caught, like the Northbrook Miller. Unfortunately, it would not be so easy for William to teach Philip a lesson. Beyond the market was a zone of tranquillity. Adjacent to the cloisters where the crossing of the old church used to be, there was an altar under a canopy with a white-haired monk standing in front of it reading from a book. On the far side of the altar, monks in neat rows were singing hymns, although at this distance their music was drowned by the noise of the marketplace. There was a small congregation. This was probably nones, a service conducted for the benefit of the monks, William thought. All work and marketing would stop for the main Michaelmas service, of course. At the far side of the priory close, the east end of the cathedral was being built. This was where Prior Philip was spending his rake-off from the market, William thought sourly. The walls were 30 or 40 feet high, and it was already possible to see the outlines of the windows and the arches of the arcade. Workers swarmed all over the site. William thought there was something odd about the way they looked, and realized after a moment that it was their colorful dress. They were not regular laborers, of course. The paid workforce would be on holiday today. These people were volunteers. He had not expected that there would be so many of them. Hundreds of men and women were carrying stones and splitting timber and rolling barrels, and heaving cartloads of sand up from the river,
all working for nothing but forgiveness of their sins. The sly prior had a crafty setup, William observed enviously. The people who came to work on the cathedral would spend money at the market. People who came to the market would give a few hours to the cathedral for their sins. Each hand washed the other. He kicked his horse forward and rode across the graveyard to the building site, curious to see it more closely. The 8 massive piers of the arcade marched down either side of the site in 4 opposed pairs. From a distance, William had thought he could see the round arches joining one pier with the next, but now he realized the arches were not built yet. What he had seen was the wooden falsework, made in the same shape, upon which the stones would rest while the arches were being constructed and the mortar was drying. The falsework did not rest on the ground, but was supported on the out-jutting mouldings of the capitals on top of the piers. Parallel with the arcade, the outer walls of the aisles were going up, with regular spaces for the windows. Midway between each window opening, a buttress jutted out from the line of the wall. Looking at the open ends of the unfinished walls, William could see that they were not solid stone. They were, in fact, double walls, with a space in between. The cavity appeared to be filled with rubble and mortar. The scaffolding was made of stout poles roped together, with trestles of flexible saplings and woven reeds laid across the poles. A lot of money had been spent here, William noted. He rode on around the outside of the chancel, followed by his knights. Against the walls were wooden lean-to huts, workshops, and lodges for the craftsmen. Most of them were locked shut now, for there were no masons laying stones or carpenters making falsework today. However, the supervising craftsmen, the master masons and the master carpenter, were directing the volunteer laborers, telling them where to stack the stones, timber, sand, and lime they were carrying up from the riverside. William rode around the east end of the church to the south side, where his way was blocked by the monastic buildings. Then he turned back, marveling at the cunning of Prior Philip, who had his master craftsmen busy on a Sunday and his laborers working for no pay. As he reflected on what he was seeing, it seemed devastatingly clear that Prior Philip was largely responsible for the decline in the fortunes of the Shiring earldom. The farms were losing their young men to the building site, and Shiring, jewel of the earldom, was being eclipsed by the growing new town of Kingsbridge. Residents here paid rent to Philip, not William, and people who bought and sold goods at this market generated income for the priory, not the earldom. And Philip had the timber, the sheep farms, and the quarry that had once enriched the earl. William and his men rode back across the close to the market. He decided to take a closer look. He urged his horse into the crowd. It inched forward. The people did not scatter fearfully out of his path. When the horse nudged them, they looked up at William with irritation or annoyance rather than dread, and moved out of the way in their own good time, with a somewhat condescending air. Nobody here was frightened of him. It made him nervous. If people were not scared, there was no telling what they might do. He went down one row and back up the next, with his knights trailing behind him. He became frustrated with the slow movement of the crowd. It would have been quicker to walk. But then, he felt sure, these insubordinate Kingsbridge people would probably have been cocky enough to jostle him. He was halfway along the return aisle when he saw Aliena. He reined in abruptly and stared at her, transfixed. She was no longer the thin, strained, frightened girl in clogs that he had seen here on Whitsunday 3 years ago. Her face, then drawn with tension, had filled out again, and she had a happy, healthy look. Her dark eyes flashed with humour, and her curls tumbled about her face when she shook her head. She was so beautiful that she made William's head swim with desire. She was wearing a scarlet robe, richly embroidered, and her expressive hands glinted with rings. There was an older woman with her, standing a little to one side like a servant. "Plenty of money," Mother had said. That was how Richard had been able to become a squire and join King Stephen's army, equipped with fine weapons. Damn her! She had been destitute, a penniless, powerless girl. How had she done it? She was at a stall that carried bone needles, silk thread,
wooden thimbles and other sewing necessities, discussing the goods animatedly with the short, dark-haired Jew who was selling them. Her stance was assertive, and she was relaxed and self-confident. She had recovered the poise she had possessed as daughter of the Earl. She looked much older. She was older, of course. William was 24, so she must be 21 now. But she looked more than that. There was nothing of the child in her now. She was mature. She looked up and met his eye. Last time he had locked glances with her, she had blushed for shame and run away. This time she stood her ground and stared back at him. He tried a knowing smile. An expression of scathing contempt came over her face. William felt himself flush red. She was as haughty as ever, and she scorned him now as she had 5 years ago. He had humiliated and ravished her, but she was no longer terrified of him. He wanted to speak to her and tell her that he could do again what he had done to her before, but he was not willing to shout it over the heads of the crowd. Her unflinching gaze made him feel small. He tried to sneer at her, but he could not, and he knew he was making a foolish grimace. In an agony of embarrassment, he turned away and kicked his horse on. But even then the crowd slowed him down, and her withering look burned into the back of his neck as he moved away from her by painful inches. When at last he emerged from the marketplace, he was confronted by Prior Philip. The short Welshman stood with his hands on his hips, and his chin thrust aggressively forward. He was not quite as thin as he used to be, and what little hair he had was turning prematurely from black to grey, William saw. He no longer looked too young for his job. Now his blue eyes were bright with anger. "Lord William," he called in a challenging tone. William tore his mind away from the thought of Aliena, and remembered that he had a charge to make against Philip. "I'm glad to come across you, Prior." "And I you," Philip said angrily, but the shadow of a doubtful frown crossed his brow. "You're holding a market here," William said accusingly. "So what? I don't believe King Stephen ever licensed a market in Kingsbridge, nor did any other king, to my knowledge." "How dare you," said Philip. "I, or anybody—" "You!" Philip shouted, overriding him. "How dare you come in here and talk about a license? You, who in the past month have gone through this county committing arson, theft, rape, and at least one murder? That's nothing to do—" "How dare you come into a monastery and talk about a license?" Philip yelled. He stepped forward, wagging his finger at William, and William's horse sidestepped nervously. Somehow Philip's voice was more penetrating than William's, and William could not get a word in. A crowd of monks, volunteer workers, and market customers was gathering around, watching the row. Philip was unstoppable. "After what you've done, there is only one thing you should say. Father, I have sinned. You should get down on your knees in this priory. You should beg for forgiveness if you want to escape the fires of hell." William blanched. Talk of hell filled him with uncontrollable terror. He tried desperately to interrupt Philip's flow, saying, "What about your market? What about your market?" Philip hardly heard. He was in a fury of indignation. "Beg forgiveness for the awful things you have done," he shouted. "On your knees! On your knees, or you'll burn in hell!" William was almost frightened enough to believe that he would suffer hellfire, unless he knelt and prayed in front of Philip right now. He knew he was overdue for confession, for he had killed many men in the war, on top of the sins he had committed during his tour of the earldom. What if he were to die before he confessed? He began to feel shaky at the thought of the eternal flames and the devils with their sharp knives. Philip advanced on him, pointing his finger and shouting, "On your knees!" William backed his horse. He looked around desperately. The crowd hemmed him in. His knights were behind him, looking bemused. They could not decide how to cope with a spiritual threat from an unarmed monk. William could not take any more humiliation. After Aliena, this was too much. He pulled on the reins, making his massive war horse rear dangerously. The crowd parted in front of its mighty hooves. When its forefeet hit the ground again, he kicked it hard and it lunged forward. The onlookers scattered. He kicked it again and it broke into a canter. Burning with shame, he fled out through the priory gate, with his knights following, like a pack of snarling dogs chased off by an old woman with a broom. William confessed his sins in fear and trembling on the cold stone floor of the little chapel at the bishop's palace. Bishop Walleran listened in silence, his face a mask of distaste, as William catalogued the killings, the beatings, and the rapes he was guilty of. Even while he confessed, William was filled with loathing for the supercilious bishop, with his clean white hands folded over his heart, and his translucent white nostrils slightly flared, as if there were a bad smell in the dusty air. It tormented William to beg Walleran for absolution, but his sins were so heavy that no ordinary priest could forgive them. So he knelt, possessed by fear, while Walleran commanded him to light a candle in perpetuity in the chapel at Earl's Castle, and then told him his sins were absolved. The fear lifted slowly, like a fog. They came out of the chapel into the smoky atmosphere of the great hall and sat by the fire. Autumn was turning to winter, and it was cold in the big stone house. A kitchen hand brought hot spiced bread made with honey and ginger. William began to feel all right at last. Then he remembered his other problems. Bartholomew's son Richard was making a bid for the earldom, and William was too poor to raise an army big enough to impress the king. He had raked in considerable cash in the past month, but it was still not sufficient. He sighed and said, "That damned monk is drinking the blood of the shiring earldom." Walleran took some bread with a pale, long-fingered hand, like a claw. "I've been wondering how long it would take you to reach that conclusion." Of course, Walleran would have worked it all out long before William. He was so superior. William would rather not talk to him, but he wanted the bishop's opinion on a legal point. "The king has never licensed a market in Kingsbridge, has he?" "To my certain knowledge, no." "Then Philip is breaking the law." Walleran shrugged his bony black-draped shoulders. "For what it's worth, yes." Walleran seemed uninterested, but William ploughed on. "He ought to be stopped." Walleran gave a fastidious smile. "You can't deal with him the way you deal with a serf who's married off his daughter without permission." William reddened. Walleran was referring to one of the sins he had just confessed. "How can you deal with him, then?" Walleran considered. "Markets are the king's prerogative. In more peaceful times he would probably handle this himself." William gave a scornful laugh. For all his cleverness, Walleran did not know the king as well as William did. "Even in peacetime he wouldn't thank me for complaining to him about an unlicensed market." "Well, then, his deputy, to deal with local matters, is the Sheriff of Sharing. What can he do?" "He could bring a writ against the priory and the county court." William shook his head. "That's the last thing I want. The court would impose a fine, the priory would pay it, and the market would continue. It's almost like giving a license." "The trouble is, there are really no grounds for refusing to let Kingsbridge have a market." "Yes, there are," said William indignantly. "It takes trade away from the market at Shiring. Shiring is a full day's journey from Kingsbridge. People will walk a long way." Walleran shrugged again. William realized he shrugged when he disagreed. Walleran said, "Tradition says a man will spend a third of a day walking to the market, a third of the day at the market, and a third of the day walking home. Therefore, a market serves the people within a third of a day's journey, which is reckoned to be 7 miles. If two markets are more than 14 miles apart, their catchment areas do not overlap. Shiring is 20 miles from Kingsbridge. According to the rule, Kingsbridge is entitled to a market, and the king should grant it." "The king does what he likes," William blustered, but he was bothered. He had not known about this rule. It put Prior Philip in a stronger position. Walleran said, "Anyway, we won't be dealing with the king, we'll be dealing with the sheriff." He frowned.
The sheriff could just order the priory to desist from holding an unlicensed market.
That's a waste of time, William said contemptuously. Who takes any notice of an order that isn't backed up by a threat?
Philip might.
William did not believe that. Why would he?
A mocking smile played around Walloran's bloodless lips. I'm not sure I can explain it to you, he said.
Philip believes that the law should be king.
Stupid idea, said William impatiently. The king is king. I said you wouldn't understand.
Walloran's knowing air infuriated William. He got up and went to the window. Looking out, he could see at the top of the nearby hill the earthworks where Walloran had started to build a castle 4 years ago. Walloran had hoped to pay for it out of the income from the Shiring earldom. Philip had frustrated his plans, and now the grass had grown back over the mounds of earth, and brambles filled the dry ditch. William recalled that Walloran had hoped to build with stone from the Earl of Shiring's quarry. Now Philip had the quarry. William mused, If I had my quarry back, I could use it as a surety and borrow money to raise an army.
Then why don't you take it back? Said Walloran.
William shook his head. I tried, once.
And Philip outmaneuvered you. But there are no monks there now. You could send a squad of men to evict the stonecutters.
And how would I stop Philip from moving back in the way he did last time?
Build a high fence around the quarry and leave a permanent guard.
It was possible, William thought eagerly, and it would solve his problem at a stroke. But what was Walloran's motive in suggesting it? Mother had warned him to beware of the unscrupulous bishop.
The only thing you need to know about Walloran, by God, she had said, is that everything he does is carefully calculated, nothing spontaneous, nothing careless, nothing casual, nothing superfluous. Above all, nothing generous.
But Walloran hated Philip and had sworn to prevent him from building his cathedral. That was motive enough. William looked thoughtfully at Walloran. His career was in a stall. He had become bishop, very young, but Kingsbridge was an insignificant and impoverished diocese, and Walloran had surely intended it to be a stepping stone to higher things. However, it was the prior, not the bishop, who was winning wealth and fame. Walloran was withering in Philip's shadow much as William was. They both had reason to want to destroy him. William decided yet again to overcome his loathing of Walloran for the sake of his own long-term interests.
All right, he said.
This could work. But suppose Philip then complains to the king? Walloran said,
You'll say you did it as a reprisal for Philip's unlicensed market.
William nodded. Any excuse will do so long as I go back to the war with a big enough army. Walloran's eyes glinted with malice.
I have a feeling Philip can't build that cathedral if he has to buy stone at a market price.
And if he stops building, Kingsbridge could go into decline.
This could solve all your problems, William.
William was not going to show gratitude.
You really hate Philip, don't you?
He's in my way, Walloran said. But for a moment William had glimpsed the naked savagery beneath the bishop's cool, calculating manner. William returned to practical matters. There must be 30 quarrymen there, some with their wives and children, he said.
So what?
There may be bloodshed.
Walloran raised his black eyebrows. Indeed, he said.
Then I shall give you absolution.
3. They set out while it was still dark in order to arrive at dawn. They carried flaming torches, which made the horses jumpy. As well as Walter and the other 4 knights, William took 6 men-at-arms. Trailing behind them were a dozen peasants who would dig the ditch and put up the fence. William believed firmly in careful military planning, which was why he and his men were so useful to King Stephen. But on this occasion he had no battle plan. It was such an easy operation that it would have been demeaning to make preparations as if it were a real fight. A few stone cutters and their families could not put up much opposition. And anyway, William remembered being told how the stone cutter's leader, was his name Otto?
Yes.
Otto Blackface, had refused to fight on the first day Tom Builder had taken his men to the quarry. A chill December morning dawned, with rags and tatters of mist hanging on the trees like poor people's washing. William disliked this time of year. It was cold in the morning and dark in the evening, and the castle was always damp. Too much salt meat and salt fish was served. His mother was bad-tempered, and the servants were surly. His nights became quarrelsome. This little fight would be good for them. It would also be good for him. He had already arranged to borrow £200 from the Jews of London against the surety of the quarry. By the end of today, his future would be secure. When they were about a mile from the quarry, William stopped, picked out two men, and sent them ahead on foot. "There may be a sentry or some dogs," he warned. "Have a bow out, ready, with an arrow at the string." A little later the road curved to the left, then ended suddenly at the sheer side of a mutilated hill. This was the quarry. All was quiet. Beside the road, William's men were holding a scared boy, presumably an apprentice who had been on sentry duty, and at his feet was a dog, bleeding to death, with an arrow through its neck. The raiding party drew up, making no particular effort to be silent. William reined in and studied the scene. Much of the hill had disappeared since last he saw it. The scaffolding ran up the hillside to inaccessible areas and down into a deep pit which had been opened up at the foot of the hill. Stone blocks of different shapes and sizes were stacked near the road, and two massive wooden carts with huge wheels were loaded with stone ready to go. Everything was covered with grey dust, even the bushes and trees. A large area of woodland had been cleared. My woodland, William thought angrily, and there were 10 or 12 wooden buildings, some with small vegetable gardens, one with a pigsty. It was a little village. The sentry had probably been asleep, and his dog, too. William spoke to him. "How many men are here, lad?" The boy looked scared but brave.
"You're Lord William, aren't you?"
"Answer the question, boy, or I'll take off your head with this sword." He went white with fear, but replied in a voice of quavering defiance, "Are you trying to steal this quarry away from Prior Philip?"
"What's the matter with me?" William thought. "I can't even frighten a skinny child with no beard. Why do people think they can defy me?"
"This quarry is mine," he hissed. "Forget about Prior Philip. He can't do anything for you now. How many men?" Instead of replying, the boy threw back his head and began to yell,
"Help! Look out! Attack! Attack!"
William's hand went to his sword. He hesitated, looking across at the houses. A scared face peered out from a doorway. He decided to forget about the apprentice. He snatched a blazing torch from one of his men and kicked his horse. He rode at the houses, carrying the torch high, and heard his men behind him. The door of the nearest hut opened, and a bleary-eyed man in an undershirt looked out. William threw the burning torch over the man's head. It landed on the floor behind him in the straw, which caught fire immediately. William gave a whoop of triumph and rode past. He went on through the little cluster of houses. Behind him his men charged, yelling and throwing their torches at the thatched roofs. All the doors opened, and terrified men, women, and children began to pour out, screaming and trying to dodge the hammering hooves. They milled about in a panic while the flames took hold. William reined in at the edge of the melee and watched for a moment. The domestic animals got loose, and a frantic pig charged around blindly while a cow stood still in the middle of it all, its stupid head weaving from side to side in bewilderment. Even the young men, normally the most belligerent group, were confused and scared. Dawn was definitely the best time for this sort of thing. There was something about being half-naked that took away people's aggression. A dark-skinned man with a thatch of black hair came out of one of the huts with his boots on and started giving orders. This must be Otto Blackface. William could not hear what he was saying. He could guess from the gestures that Otto was telling the women to pick up the children and hide in the woods. But what was he saying to the men? A moment later, William found out. Two young men ran to a hut, set apart from the others, and opened its door, which was locked from the outside. They stepped in and re-emerged with heavy stone-cutters' hammers. Otto directed other men to the same hut,
which was obviously a tool shed. They were going to make a fight of it. 3 years ago, Otto had refused to fight for Philip. What had changed his mind? Whatever it was going to kill him. William smiled grimly and drew his sword. There were now 6 or 8 men armed with sledgehammers and long-handled axes. William spurred his horse and charged at the group around the door of the tool shed. They scattered out of his way, but he swung his sword and managed to catch one of them with a deep cut to the upper arm. The man dropped his axe. William galloped away, then turned his horse. He was breathing hard and feeling good. In the heat of a battle, there was no fear, only excitement. Some of his men had seen what was happening and looked to William for guidance. He beckoned them to follow him, then charged the stone cutters again. They could not dodge 6 knights as easily as they could dodge 1. William struck down 2 of them, and several more fell to the swords of his men, although he was moving too fast to count how many, or to see whether they were dead or just wounded. When he turned again, Otto was rallying his forces. As the knights charged, the stone cutters dispersed into the cluster of burning houses. It was a clever tactic, William realized regretfully. The knights followed, but it was easier for the stone cutters to dodge when they were split up, and the horses shied away from the blazing buildings. William chased a grey-haired man with a hammer and just missed him several times, before the man evaded him by running through a house with a burning roof. William realized that Otto was the problem. He was giving the stone-cutters courage, as well as organizing them. As soon as he fell, the others would give up. William reined in his horse and looked for the dark-skinned man. Most of the women and children had disappeared, except for 2 5-year-olds, standing in the middle of the battlefield, holding hands and crying. William's knights were charging between the houses, chasing the stone-cutters. To his surprise, William saw that one of his men-at-arms had fallen to a hammer and lay on the ground, groaning and bleeding. William was dismayed. He had not anticipated any casualties on his own side. A distraught woman was running in and out of burning houses, calling out something William could not hear. She was searching for someone. Finally, she saw the 2 5-year-olds, and picked them up, 1 in each arm. As she ran away, she almost collided with one of William's knights, Gilbert de Reims. Gilbert raised his sword to strike her. Suddenly, Otto sprang out from behind a hut and swung a long-handled axe. His handling of the weapon was skillful, and its blade sliced right through Gilbert's thigh and bit into the wood of the saddle. The severed leg dropped to the ground, and Gilbert screamed and fell off his horse. He would never fight again. Gilbert was a valuable knight. Angry, William spurred his horse forward. The woman with the children vanished. Otto was struggling to pull the blade of his axe from Gilbert's saddle. He looked up and saw William coming. If he had run at that moment, he might have escaped, but he stayed and tugged at his axe. It came free when William was almost on him. William raised his sword. Otto stood his ground and lifted the axe. At the last moment, William realized the axe was going to be used on the horse, and the stone-cutter could cripple the animal before William was close enough to strike him down. William hauled on the reins desperately, and the horse skidded to a halt and reared up, turning its head away from Otto. The blow fell on the horse's neck, and the edge of the axe bit deeply into the powerful muscles. Blood spurted like a fountain, and the horse fell. William was off its back before the huge body hit the ground. He was enraged. The war horse had cost a fortune and had survived with him through a year of civil war, and it was maddening to lose it to a quarryman's axe. He jumped over its body and lunged furiously at Otto with the sword. Otto was no easy victim. He held his axe in both hands and used its heart of oak handle to parry William's sword. William struck harder and harder, driving him back. Despite his age, Otto was powerfully muscled, and William's blows hardly jarred him. William took his sword in both hands and struck harder. Once again the handle of the axe intervened, but this time William's blade stuck in the wood. Then Otto was advancing and William was retreating. William tugged hard at his sword, and his blade came unstuck, but now Otto was almost on him. Suddenly William was afraid for his life. Otto raised the axe. William dodged back.
His heel connected with something, and he stumbled and fell backward over the body of his horse. He landed in a puddle of warm blood, but managed to keep hold of his sword. Otto stood over him with his axe raised. As the weapon came down, William rolled frantically sideways. He felt the wind as the blade sliced the air next to his face. Then he sprang to his feet and thrust at the stonecutter with his sword. A soldier would have moved sideways before pulling his weapon out of the ground, knowing that a man is at his most vulnerable when he has just struck a blow and missed. But Otto was no soldier, just a brave fool, and he was standing with one hand on the haft of the axe and the other arm stretched out for balance, leaving the whole of his body an easy target. William's hasty thrust was almost blind, but nevertheless it connected. The point of the sword pierced Otto's chest. William pushed harder, and the blade slid between the man's ribs. Otto released his hold on the axe, and over his face came an expression William knew well. His eyes showed surprise, his mouth opened as if to scream, although no sound came, and his skin suddenly looked grey. It was the look of a man who has received a mortal wound. William thrust the blade home, harder, just to make sure, then pulled it out. Otto's eyes rolled up in his head, a bright red stain appeared on his shirt front, and instantly grew large, and he fell. William spun round, scanning the whole scene. He saw two stonecutters running away, presumably having seen their leader killed. As they ran, they shouted to the others. The fight turned into a retreat. The knights chased the runaways. William stood still, breathing hard. The damned quarryman had fought back. He looked at Gilbert. He lay still in a pool of blood with his eyes closed. William put a hand on his chest. There was no heartbeat. Gilbert was dead. William walked around the still-burning houses, counting bodies. Three stonecutters lay dead, plus a woman and a child who both looked as if they had been trampled by horses. Three of William's men-at-arms were wounded, and four horses were dead or crippled. When he had completed his count, he stood by the corpse of his warhorse. He had liked that horse better than he liked most people. After a battle, he usually felt exhilarated, but now he was depressed. It was a shambles. This should have been a simple operation to chase off a group of helpless workmen, and it had turned into a pitched battle with high casualties. The knights chased the stonecutters as far as the woods, but there the horses could not catch the men, so they turned back. Walter rode up to where William stood and saw Gilbert, dead on the ground. He crossed himself and said, "Gilbert has killed more men than I have. There aren't so many like him that I can afford to lose one in a squabble with a damned monk," William said bitterly, "to say nothing of the horses." "What a turn-up," Walter said. "These people put up more of a fight than Robert of Gloucester's rebels." William shook his head in disgust. "I don't know," he said, looking around at the bodies. "What the devil did they think they were fighting for?" Chapter 9. Just after dawn, when most of the brothers were in the crypt for the service of prime, there were only two people in the dormitory, Johnny Eightpence sweeping the floor at one end of the long room, and Jonathan playing school at the other. Prior Philip paused in the doorway and watched Jonathan. He was almost 5 years old, an alert, confident boy with a childish gravity that charmed everyone. Johnny still dressed him in a miniature monk's habit. Today Jonathan was pretending to be the novice master, giving lessons to an imaginary row of pupils. "That's wrong, Godfrey," he said sternly to the empty bench. "No dinner for you if you don't learn your verbs." He meant verbs. Philip smiled fondly. He could not have loved a son more deeply. Jonathan was the one thing in life that gave him sheer, unadulterated joy. The child ran around the priory like a puppy, petted and spoiled by all the monks. To most of them he was just like a pet, an amusing plaything. But to Philip and Johnny he was something more. Johnny loved him like a mother, and Philip, though he tried to conceal it, felt like the boy's father. Philip himself had been raised from a young age by a kindly abbot, and it seemed the most natural thing in the world for him to play the same role with Jonathan. He did not tickle or chase him the way the monks did, but he told him Bible stories and played counting games with him, and kept an eye on Johnny.
He went into the room, smiled at Johnny, and sat on the bench with the imaginary schoolboys. "Good morning, Father," Jonathan said solemnly. Johnny had taught him to be scrupulously polite. Philip said, "How would you like to go to school?" "I know."